Okay, so today is Monday, November 17, 2025. We're in the studios of the Vincent Voice Library at Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. I'm Matthew Wilcox, audiovisual archivist in the Media Preservation Unit of the MSU Libraries, interviewing Bob Page, former station manager for WKAR-TV, to talk about the early years of educational television at WKAR. Mr. Page, do you give us permission to record this interview?
Absolutely.
Thank you. I'd like to start with your earliest memories of Michigan State College, and you touched on this a little bit on the way up here. You arrived on campus in 1950, is that right?
Fall of 50, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what interests were you pursuing or wanted to pursue at that time?
I thought I wanted to get in the radio business.
Okay.
Because TV wasn't that big when I was in high school, so
okay.
Radio sounded interesting.
What led you to that career choice, to radio?
I don't know. It was certainly nothing from my background. My father was a mechanical contractor. I hadn't done any radio work. I just thought it was an attractive business to get into.
That sounds good. So after a few announcing gigs, you got into television. Did you do any work with television development prior to WKAR-TV going on the air in 1954?
I did. That's where I got started.
Okay.
Television development was on the fifth floor of the Electrical Engineering Building.
Ah.
Which is now the Computer Center.
Okay.
And they had a studio up there and a classroom and offices and a kinescope room.
We talked about kinescopes earlier, and I'm going to touch on that again in a moment. You became a camera operator in 1954, the year that WKAR-TV went live.
Well, that's when I was hired full-time.
Oh, okay.
I ran camera and did odds and ends up in the television development area, excuse me, starting in the, must have been the fall of 52.
Okay.
Or 50, fall of 52, yeah.
Fall of 52. What kind of programming did you see the television development taking into?
They did a thing called Town and Country that was produced by the Cooperative Extension Service.
Mm-hmm.
We did the Biggie Munn Show. And I remember doing a program with the governor, G. Menon Williams. I think we did a monthly, I don't know how frequent it was, but a regular program with G. Menon Williams.
I think I remember this one, Televisit with the Governor?
Televisit with the Governor. I didn't pay much attention to the titles and that sort of thing. I was just running camera.
I'm glad you mentioned the Biggie Munn Show because I read just a little bit about it. That was a collaboration with WJIM-TV?
Yes. We fed somehow fed the signal to WJIM, and they broadcast it.
Okay.
I don't know if it was also kinescoped.
Yeah, I've been trying to track down copies of the Biggie Munn Show.
Okay.
I've written to an engineer at WJIM. I haven't gotten any word back yet, but I'm hoping they're still in existence. I think they'd be fascinating to watch.
I remember a program with a folk singer. I couldn't tell you his name, but
Richard Dyer Bennett?
Richard Dyer Bennett, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
We did quite a few of those programs, as I recall.
Okay. Oh, wow. So WKR produced a lot of kinescopes in the early years, like 52, 53, 54.
54 would have been the start of WKAR-TV's kinescopes. Before that, it would have been television development.
Okay, so there's a difference. Are you saying there's a difference in the way the kinescopes were created between television development?
No, I'm just saying that WKAR didn't go on the air until 1954.
Okay.
But they were doing kinescopes back in the Electrical Engineering Building prior to that.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit more about how kinescopes were created in the studios?
Well, I'm not a technician or a technical person. I'm strictly a production guy or administrative guy. I know what a kinescope recorder looks like.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big box And it has a motion picture camera on one end and a television picture tube on the other end. And the motion picture camera photographs the images that are on the picture tube,
okay,
which are usually sent from a live studio. And while a live television program is going on, the motion picture camera is recording the image. The difference is the screen is blue. The television picture is blue, shades of blue,
okay,
rather than shades of gray, because blue photographs better than any other color, I'm told.
Okay.
The other thing is motion pictures go at 24 frames per second.
Right.
Television at that time went at 30 frames per second.
Mm-hmm.
So underneath this combination of equipment was somehow conversion equipment that would adjust the speed of the picture tube, I guess, to 24 frames per second. And if you looked at it, you'd see all kinds of fluttering on the screen. But ultimately, after they developed the motion picture, it looked just like a photograph.
Okay.
A motion picture photograph.
Now, I'm curious why the studios made the decision to record content on kinescope rather than directly onto film. Was there a reasoning for using kinescope in the earlier years?
Well, because you're using television cameras, television equipment.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to put it directly on film, you'd have a different process altogether. You'd have to have film cameras.
Okay.
And with television, you feed everything, all that signal into a switcher, so you can select, as you go.
Right.
You don't have to do the editing after the fact. You're editing as the program is going along.
Okay. Yeah, I see. So
and that makes it simpler than to just record the output of that switcher to the television screen and record it.
Right. Okay. So the difference in the frame per second rate.
Right.
Okay. All right. So what kind of difficulties did you experience creating productions in the early 1950s? Are there any that sort of stand out in your memory?
Well, when we moved into the Quonset hut in 54, mm-hmm. It was fall of 53, but went on the air in January of 54.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, what was the question again?
Oh, I was just asking what kind of difficulties you experienced with early television productions.
Well, it was pretty much the same as it was in the television development studio, except now we had three studios and larger studios,
mm-hmm.
Larger sets. It was pretty limited to what you could do in that one small studio in TV development. But
right.
In the Quonsets, we had two fairly good-sized studios and one small studio.
I did read that soundproofing was a bit of an issue with the Quonset huts.
Soundproofing was a problem.
Yeah.
Depending on what program, we used to do recital programs, music recital programs.
Oh, yeah.
And if a plane went over, or if it happened to be raining hard or sleeting or anything like that, you pretty much had to stop.
Okay.
Unless it was live, and
right.
Then it went on. But if you were doing a recording, the noise was pretty bad. They had sprayed insulation on the inside of the Quonset huts.
Okay.
But it wasn't enough to stop the noise hitting that metal or planes going by, even a siren going off or something like that would often end a recording session, or at least pause it. But if it was live, I say it, you just kept going.
Was temperature often a consideration?
Well, it was air conditioned.
Hmm.
Well, moderately air conditioned. The area that was most prominently air-conditioned was the videotape recording room, once we had videotape, because that equipment needed to be kept at a cool temperature. In the studios, you just kept the fan on until you were starting the recording, and then you turned it off and hoped it didn't get too hot while you were recording. We used a lot of lights, obviously, mm-hmm. at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Much more than required now, I'm sure.
What prompted the discontinuation of the use of kinescopes? Was it the conversion to videotape?
Videotape, absolutely.
Okay.
Kinescope was a very cumbersome thing, and plus you had to pay some film company to process the whole negative. You're producing a negative with that camera, and then you have to create copies from the negative.
Right.
Or I think that's the way it goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't think you can... You can't change what's on the film. You have a negative, and you make positives from that negative.
Right.
But it was not a satisfactory form of duplication. It just didn't look anywhere near as good as the live television picture.
Mm-hmm.
So when magnetic recording came along, that was a much preferable answer to recording programs.
With the kinescopes, I'd often wondered if it was a budgetary decision.
I don't think so. I think if videotape had been available at the beginning of television development, I'm sure they would have gone for videotape rather than kinescope.
Okay. Were there regularly a certain number of different stations in the mid-Michigan area that you would send copies of kinescopes to?
I'm not sure how all that worked, to be honest with you. I know they did send programs to stations in Detroit and probably to Lansing and maybe other places in the state.
Mm-hmm. Imagine Grand Rapids, possibly.
Grand Rapids, Marquette, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I don't remember. When we were in the early videotape business and we're part of what was any PBS, which was NET before it was PBS,
right.
National Educational Television.
Mm-hmm.
The way you got programs from NET was on a bicycle. They would bicycle the videotape because we had no interconnected network.
Mm-hmm.
So not until Sesame Street came along. I don't remember exactly what year that might have been.
Late 60s, I think?
It was in the 60s,
possibly.
Yeah. If I ponder for a second here, 68 we went. Yeah, it was probably late 60s when we got our first videotape recorder. But it was also about the same time that PBS set up an interconnected network.
Okay.
So you could be part of a real network and get programs that are fed by that network, ultimately by satellite,
mm-hmm.
Run it at that time or record it for a later broadcast. But we physically had to bicycle, he called it, the videotapes from one station to the other in the early days of PBS or NET. So that was a major operation. It was, as a matter of fact, it was housed in Ann Arbor.
Okay.
Their technical center was in Ann Arbor, and they did all the duplicating and distributing of early videotapes from Ann Arbor.
Right.
And we would get a program, and we'd automatically send it on to a station in, I don't know, Duluth or Marquette. It was a standard shipping process to get those tapes. So if you were at the tail end of a bicycle, you might not get the program for a month or two after it was actually aired.
Oh, wow. And I have to imagine, I mean, the early years of videotape, the giant 2-inch quad tapes, open reel, 1-inch open reel tapes.
Well, the 2-inch was the first big thing.
Right.
And it was wonderful.
Sounds it heavy, though.
Cumbersome. It wasn't cumbersome at all. It was great.
Oh, okay.
But you had to do the only way you could edit was physically cut the tape.
Oh, okay.
Just like you would cut an audio tape.
Right. Wow.
Now, and we only had one machine, so there was no transferring back and forth or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the quality of the picture was so much superior to kinescopes that we were elated with what we could do on videotape.
I'd like to backtrack a little bit, if I may. Mm-hmm. In 1959, WKER joined into a shared broadcasting arrangement with WILX-TV and changed the call letters to WMSB. Were there any significant difficulties in the transition?
Well, first of all, there was concern about Channel 60, which is what WKAR was originally.
Right.
There was no audience out there for it. Very limited audience. Mm-hmm. In those days, you had to get a box on top of your TV with a Channel 60 record dial on it or something, or they could put a strip in your TV set to receive Channel 60, but it just had not become what UHF television today is.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, it was so limited that the university decided we can't stay on this channel. It's not adequate. And apparently the FCC added a channel to our area, Channel 10, that hadn't been there originally when the university applied for a broadcast station.
Mm-hmm.
So it was going to be very competitive, obviously. A lot of entities would like to have had that channel. And somehow the university and WILX got talking and they came up with the idea of a shared time arrangement, which is what they called it. And both stations applied, both entities applied, and ultimately received the authorization from the FCC. The FCC was kind of intrigued by the idea that you wouldn't have to have a separate channel for public stations, public programs, and another one for commercial programs. And so this seemed like a good solution to the demand that both of the entities wanted to have to get that station. I don't know how they actually came to the contract. I know I talked to the university attorney at one time. His name was Leland Carr. And he mentioned what they went through to get that arrangement agreed upon.
Mm-hmm.
And WMSB, we went from WKAR to WMSB, the thinking being that we could become Michigan State Broadcasting, and maybe we'd change the radio station to WMSB, but I guess the radio station didn't care for that idea.
Mm, right.
Where the WKAR letters came from, nobody knows.
I've heard they were just random.
They were just arbitrarily assigned by the FCC, apparently. Yeah.
Nothing to do with the automobile industry.
No. We had the program manager at WKAR at the time was named Ken Richards.
Mm.
And they thought, well, maybe it's named after him, Kenneth A. Richards.
Ah.
But okay. He said, no, it's not the way it worked. It was just a coincidence. So, yes, it was a tactic to try to improve the audience for the university's programming.
Mm.
And as I say, we had 38 hours a week. Originally, the hours, as I recall, were from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., and then 6 to 7:30. That's all, except on weekends, I think we had maybe till 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday and Sunday.
Mm.
But after a few years of that, nobody was very happy with with the limited time available to the university.
Mm.
So it couldn't have been too long after that. Well, yes, it was. I don't want to jump ahead on your question.
No, please, go right ahead.
It wasn't until Clifton Wharton became president in 70 or 71.
Right, 70.
70. Yeah. And we had a chance to make a presentation to him about our broadcasting operations and an opportunity to make a pitch to get onto a full-time channel and to get rid of the shared time arrangement because it just wasn't satisfactory. You weren't able to reach people at the times when they're most likely to be watching television, in the evenings for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And he seemed to be intrigued with the idea.
Thank goodness.
And he permitted us to apply for a grant from the National Telecommunications, NTIA was the grant, the grantee, the grantor of those grants for television activation. There were a lot of public stations that hadn't gone on the air yet in 1970. So they came up with a federal program to provide grants to assist, and they could also, you could also become eligible, as Michigan State did, to activating a new channel. And eventually we got a grant, and eventually we got the license from the FCC, and Clifton Wharton was very instrumental in convincing the board of agriculture, I think it was at the time, that this would be a good move. And it might cost a little bit, but it'd be worth it.
I believe the WMSB arrangement lasted until about 1972.
That's when the new channel went on the air.
Okay.
Channel 23.
Right.
Went on the air in 1972. I think it was September of 72. Ironically, the FCC had a rule that you couldn't be operating a television station and applying for another television station at the same time.
Oh.
So WKAR was forced to go off the air, WMSB was forced to go off the air in July of 1971, I think it was.
Oh, okay.
And we didn't do any broadcasting at all until September of 72, because that was the requirement. So there were a lot of people sitting around trying to create new programs, which most of which didn't get to fruition, but it was a requirement that the FCC, I don't think they have that kind of requirement anymore, but that was the requirement back then.
The shared time arrangement that WKER had with WILX, was it the first of its kind that you know of?
First and only that I know of, yeah.
Okay.
By the way, the university got, I think it was something like $2.3 million from WILX when they turned the rest of the channel over to them. And that helped greatly to cover the costs of colorizing. We didn't have color equipment, so we were able to get color cameras, and the transmitter itself was more expensive than the grant we got from the NTIA, so that money came in handy, and it didn't cost the university anything out of pocket.
That's great. you became the station manager of WKR in 1968, I believe, and it's a position you held for over 20 years. What were some of the most remarkable changes you saw taking place in public television over those years?
Well, satellite interconnection, I think, was certainly a big one. We got a huge satellite dish that we parked outside the Quonset hut I'm not exactly sure when that was. It was early 70s anyway.
Okay.
And that way we got the programs as they're fed from PBS in Washington. That was a big change. Being able to carry programs simultaneously, I think it was a major new development for us and for other stations, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
What else was going on in those years?
Moved into the ComArts building in 1982, I believe.
Oh, well, and by 1981, I think it was, we moved into the ComArts building.
Mm-hmm.
We became part of, administratively, WKAR-TV was part of the continuing education service, I think.
Okay.
And Armand Hunter, who was the director of TV, reported to somebody over there in Kellogg Center. And ultimately, he became director of the continuing education service. And so then the station stayed under his management during those years in the 70s. We bounced around quite a bit. They put us under a program called Academic Services.
Okay.
If I could think of the name of the gentleman who was head of it, I would tell you that. Then they moved us under the provost's office. And a nice man by the name of Bob Davis was an assistant provost, and he was then our channel of administration.
Mm-hmm.
Then they moved us to the College of Education because they thought maybe that made more sense. And that was never a really comfortable arrangement. And then eventually they moved back to the College of Communication Arts and Sciences.
Yeah.
And that was probably in, probably about the time we moved into the ComArts building.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
About
early
1981.
80s. Okay.
Right? And I think it's still there.
Yes.
So all of those challenges were a little bit different than each of the one before it, but somehow we seemed to survive it. And they thought, you know, the only way to get us out of the Quonset Hut was to make us part of a larger operation, and the College of Communications seemed like the logical place, and it turned out to be just right.
That's great. Last question. What was the most unusual thing you experienced during your years at WKAR?
What was the most unusual thing? I had an office on the corner of the Quonset Hut, and every spring I looked forward to a weed coming up through the floor of that office, and I knew that everything was okay. Because as long as that weed came up, we were good. I'm sure there were more unusual things than that. Getting out of the Quonset Hut was certainly a great change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ironically, when we first moved into that Quonset Hut, people would come from all over the country to look at this fantastic facility that Michigan State had for our television broadcasting operation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was nicely done. There were, what, three huge Quonsets joined together, and then some add-on partitions for offices. We had a conference room. We had three studios. We had cameras. For university people especially, this was something that they wished that they could have at their institution. So they would often have, they have the National Association of Educational Broadcasters would often have meetings at Michigan State so people could see the wonderful facilities that it had in the Quonset huts there. That was unusual. What else was unusual? We did a lot of programs that received national distribution, most of them in the fine arts area. We had a very capable fine arts producer who had a PhD in music and would do programs with the College of the Department of Music at that time. Now it's the College of Music.
Right.
And also he brought in people from around the country. He had a series called Young Musicians or Young Musical Artists. And he had a contact in New York who he had gone to Northwestern with, and she ran an artist, what do you call it? Management, I guess, of artists. And he would be able to get young, upcoming people. We had people like, let me think of some of those names. Yo-Yo Ma.
Oh, yeah.
Paul Zukofsky. I'm trying to remember if we didn't. Well, anyway, a lot of people who became well known got their first taste of television in our Quonset hut.
Yeah, I believe that was Yo-Yo Ma's first televised performance.
I believe so.
You also had one of my personal favorite musicians, Murray Pariah.
Murray Pariah, yes. Murray Pariah helped Don go to the Steinway factory in New York and pick out a 9-foot Steinway grand.
Oh.
And what was interesting about that, I think previously the university had bought a lot of pianos from a place called Reeder. And I forget, it's St. John's or Charlotte, something, anyway. And after Don and Murray Pariah had gone to the factory in New York and picked out the one they wanted, Reeder, we had to go through purchasing, get the low bid, and Reeder, it was the guy in Grand Rapids. It was the guy in Grand Rapids. I'm sorry, I'm all mixed up on this. But a music dealer in Grand Rapids submitted the low bid. And he wouldn't be able to get the same piano that Murray and Don had picked up. So we had to go over and meet with the fellow in Grand Rapids. It ultimately did go through Reeder. They had agreed, Reeder was the person that sent Murray and Don to the Steinway factory. You had to have a dealer who could forward you or refer you, I guess. So he got undercut by the Grand Rapids guy. So we had to go talk to the Grand Rapids guy, and he said, okay, I'll relinquish if you make Reeder meet my price. So we got a better deal out of it in the long run, and we got the piano that Don and Murray Pariah selected in New York. I think it was something like $17,500 or something for a 9-foot Steinway, which we probably paid $25,000 for at the time. I don't know what it would be now.
It still sounds like a bargain.
It was a bargain, ultimately.
I thought I heard a story about a bull in an elevator.
Well, that was the electrical engineering building.
Oh, okay.
That was the elevator.
The very early years.
Yeah, and I remember I did get in the elevator with, I guess it was a bull. Because they were bringing him up for this town and country cooperative extension series that we were doing. Yeah, that was the only way to get to the fifth floor. They wouldn't want it. They couldn't get the bull to climb 5 sets of stairs, I'm sure. It was one of the interesting things that happened, yes. But when is the time? We had animals in studios, and there were always accidents and things like that that happened.
Sure. That's great. That's wonderful. Bob Page, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.